Accession number 28361, Reel 17.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 17. You were saying that the people at Shrivenham didn't seem to have much interest in what they were teaching.
No, I think they regarded us as sort of a bit of extra work, which was unwelcome, in that we weren't doing the proper course, and that we were, you know, and also I think we made it quite plain that we thought the whole thing was a bit of a pain too. And so I think it was probably mutual. I'd never been any good at physics at school. And really didn't even understand what they were talking about most of the time. And I was heartily glad when the thing was over and get on with the staff course proper.
What was on the syllabus of the staff college proper when you went there?
It was divided into terms. The first term was the term where you learnt staff duties and service writing. Obviously you learnt it before, but where they honed up they regarded as your insufficient knowledge of it, and you wrote masses of papers and essays and had to learn, you know, organisations almost by heart or where to look them up, and really it was sort of the minutiae of staff duties was term one.
What's the system and style of service writing as the army taught it, the same as you had been using in the Marines?
Oh yes, because we used the army system totally.
Presumably then, having been adjutant, you would have been familiar with some of the...
I didn't find that difficult because I'd been doing that all the time.
You had 2 years of that.
Yeah, yes. And so that, I mean, it was just a bit dreary. It was always, the first term was always regarded as the rather dreary term. At Camberley, it was a sort of hair shirt term. Really, it was sort of traditionally like that, and you accepted it, and it was all a bit of a laugh, really. The next term was one of them in the most fun terms, because you did tactics, a lot of it outdoors, you did a lot of toots, and it was conventional war, i.e. without nuclear, and you did all the phases of war, advance, withdrawal, relief, and like the whole damn thing, you know, several times over.
Up to what level? What scale of formation?
Division.
Divisional level.
Yeah. Then the next term, term three, was unconventional, counterinsurgency or internal security or whatever the buzzword was at the time. I can't remember what it was.
Revolutionary warfare, perhaps?
Well, not so much. It was... I can't remember what it was called, but you did all the sort of things like, sort of true counter-revolutionary warfare. You did things like jungle operations in a conventional way. In other words, we'd do a map exercise in Burma, for example. We're using not fighting guerrillas, but fighting a conventional enemy. We did a desert phase. So it was everything not European, running from revolutionary warfare and policing. We did an exercise set in Hong Kong, which we did with Bram's Hill Police College. And it wasn't called, I mean, it was the maps with Hong Kong, but it was called something else.
Did that involve officers from the Hong Kong police?
Those who were at Bram's Hill College, yes. Came and sat in, those that happened to be there. And if you were lucky, you had a Hong Kong policeman in your syndicate who could help you quite a lot. So that was term three, and that ended with... And at the end of term two, we had a telephone battle, which was a conventional war battle, where we all took roles within the divisional staff. So one chap was the divisional commander.
You were saying that you all had to play various parts by turns of the divisional staff.
Yes. Well, we actually, you didn't change during the telephone battle because it didn't last long enough.
No.
So one student, there were three divisions at Camberley, A, B and C.
Yes.
So there were three divisions playing, not against each other, but each doing their own thing. Mm. So one student would be the divisional commander, then he'd be his chief of staff, his logisticians and all the various people on the staff. Mm. Then other people would play brigade commanders and their staffs, and then other people would play battalion commanders all the way down the chain. Mm. And then other people would be playing the sort of the enemy bits. Mm. And it was all, I mean, pretty low-tech stuff in those days. There were no computers, of course, any of that. So it was just telephones and you played a straight, ordinary battle without nuclear weapons in Europe. Mm. And at the end of the third term, in fact, the exercise there was a joint exercise with the Navy, because at the end of the third term, leading up to the summer break, you had a 2 weeks joint period with the Navy and Air Force staff colleges. And the final exercise, which wasn't done with the Navy and Air Force present, I might say, was a joint exercise, and I was the brigade commander of the 3rd Commander Brigade for this exercise, having to carry out an amphibious landing on the island of Manus in the Pacific Islands.
Quite a remote.
Anyway, so that ended the third term, which you covered a whole range of subtopics. Mm. Then you had the fifth term, which came after, the fourth term, which came after the Christmas, after the summer break, and that was the nuclear term, when you did tactics with nuclear weapons thrown in for good measure. And the exercise at the end of that term was a nuclear exercise. And then the final term was a lot more jointery with the Army, the Navy and Air Force staff colleges, and a bit of a sweeping up term, really, covering things you hadn't covered in the previous terms, but the main concentration on the students' minds was A, that they were going to be leaving and they knew their jobs, what jobs they were going to go to, and secondly, the great staff college pantomime, which occupied a great deal of the energies of the students in the last term. Mm. So that was Camberley.
And what was the method of instruction, primarily?
The method of instruction at Camberley was lectures, central lectures in the Allenbrook Hall. Mm. So suppose you were doing the advance phase. You'd start with a lecture in the Allenbrook Hall, probably with a huge cloth model laid out on the floor, possibly a film, an instructional film. And then you'd go away and have discussions in syndicate. That was the great strength of the Camberley system. I think it was the Staff College of Camberley that invented the syndicate system. Mm. I think it was Boney Fuller after the First World War who invented the system, which is, of course, the DS is there not to instruct, but to direct the flow of our inspired minds, is how one rather cynical DS put it to us, and through discussion. So in the syndicate, you'd then discuss various aspects of the advance, and then you'd go out and do a toot about that out on the ground, which might last for a couple of days. So that was the general method of instruction of all topics, really.
Were you in the same syndicate all the way through?
No. You were in a different syndicate all five times. So you were mixed up, and occasionally, of course, you found yourself in the same syndicate as someone you'd been in with before. But on the whole, you were with a different lot of people. And you had a different DS, too.
Now, you mentioned that in the first term, you had a lot of written work to do. Did you have to do written work in the other terms as well?
Oh, yes. There was some written work to do, but not nearly as much. Mm. And, of course, there were no word processors in those days. No one could type. Everything was written in longhand.
Yeah. And what sort of writing did you have to do on the subsequent terms? Were you preparing orders and appreciations?
Yes. It was orders and appreciations. I think there was an essay at some stage. I can't remember what the topic was. Mm. But the writing got less and less as you went through the year.
Mm. And it's been said sometimes that really performance in the pantomime was the most important thing. Would you say that was true or not?
No, I think it was said tongue in cheek, and also. of course, by the time the pantomime came along, you got your job.
Yeah.
So your I mean, you actually got your job based on your first 6 months at Camberley, because the jobs were all being discussed at the beginning of the fourth term, after the summer break.
And what was your job then?
Well, I got sent to the Far East, to the Far East Land Forces, and because being a Marine, I was appointed by the Royal Marines and not by the Staff College, and my colonel came up to me and commiserated and said, if you'd been in the army, you would have got a much better job. And I was sent to be the Staff Captain Q Ops Plans in HQ Far Elf. In those days, most students went to grade 2 jobs, and the ones that hadn't done so well went to grade 3 jobs, and they would then be made up if they did all right after their first year. But I was, being a Royal Marine, I was appointed on the Royal Marine system, and being sent to a grade 3 job was no disgrace for a Royal Marine, because we were being appointed by our own appointers. But it was a job with an army headquarters, which I was glad about.
Why were you glad?
Well, because A, it was in the Far East, which was fun to go to. Secondly, it was accompanied, so I could take my family. Thirdly, I didn't want to work at Royal Marine headquarters in London, which had a bad reputation as being a bloody awful headquarters to work in.
Why was that? What was wrong with it?
I think because, I mean, I know I'm sort of talking against my own organisation, but at that particular stage, the Royal Marines were very inward-looking. And this was largely because, you know, they were permanently under the threat of the axe. So the whole time was spent defending the Royal Marines' position, which is really...
Justifying yourself.
Yeah, it was pretty boring, really. Yeah. Much more fun to go to the Far East, where a lot of one's chums were going to be, and all the chaps who'd been at Camberley were going out to army headquarters around the world. And the great joy of going to Camberley, of course, was that wherever you went in the world, in the headquarters, there would be someone who'd been at Camberley with you. You know, in every brigade, divisional, corps, headquarters in the world, there'd be somebody who'd been at Camberley. So when I arrived at Far Elf, there must have been 10 people in the headquarters who'd been at Camberley with me. And all the guys in brigades in Borneo, because that was going on at the time, had been at Camberley with me. So it was a sort of like a club. It helped oil the wheels of the business of the day, because you knew the people you were talking to.
What does a staff captain of Q Ops plans do?
Well, it turned out actually quite an interesting job, because the Q Ops is the interface between logistics and G, which in those days was operations, and so our cell worked in the bit of Far Elf that was, if you like, the real inner circle of the headquarters, which worked in a separate place from the main headquarters. We were located in a place called Phoenix Park, which was the headquarters of the joint headquarters in Singapore, i.e. the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief Far East, which was a joint headquarters. And we were in the army cell there. And so, in rough terms, the G boys, the ops boys, would come to us and say, we want to do this, and this is what we're going to do. And so we made it logistically possible. Wow. So we were involved in all the contingency plans. We were involved, I was very deeply involved in the Borneo campaign, because the things that they wanted to do in Borneo, I had to make happen. And so actually it was very interesting.
What stage was the fighting in Borneo then, by then?
It was the last year of confrontation.
What sort of things did the ops staff want to do that you had to support?
Well, for example, if they were going to do some sort of kind of special operation, like some of the, you know, cross-border operations, they might want special kit, which was one's job to get hold of. They might want to move a base and set it up somewhere else, or do something that involved logisticians' decisions and logisticians' support. And so that was the sort of thing I got involved in, and that side. And then on the planning side, I was involved with the CETO plans, because remember CETO was on at that time, CETO. So the contingency planning for the CETO plans, I provided some of the input for. And no sooner had Borneo finished than Hong Kong reared its ugly head, and all the riots in Hong Kong. So you had to do things like sail LSLs and get stocks of barbed wire shipped up to Hong Kong, or ammunition. And then another fun thing was they decided to revise all the contingency plans for the Southwest Pacific. And we had plans to go to the Solomon Islands, the New Hebrides, the Gilbert and Ellis Islands, and Fiji, if there was some kind of trouble there. Mm-hmm. So a very enterprising colonel, who'd actually been a DS of mine at Camberley, said, "I've been told I've got to fly round all these islands and do the planning. Would you like to come as my logistics planner?" So I said, "Yes, thank you very much." So we were given an airplane, an RAF airplane, and about five of us spent what was almost like a sort of world tour holiday flying round these islands, places I'd never been to before and never been to since, looking at the contingency plans. And I was responsible for putting together the logistic element of the contingency plan, had we ever operated there.
You mentioned Gilbert and Ellis Islands, Solomon Islands. What kind of threat are we talking about here?
We were talking about
civil disorder.
And we're talking about probably putting in a company, at most a battalion, to sort out civil disorder. I mean, we're not talking about the Japanese invading them or anything like that, or even the Russians or the Chinese.
Were these contingencies considered immediate or remote?
I don't know. But the colonel decided that he was responsible for these plans, and therefore he'd like to do a personal recce. Being a smooth-talking Coldstream Guardsman, he was able to talk his boss into sending him with a small team on what turned out to be a once-in-a-lifetime trip around the Southwest Pacific.
Fiji, of course, has always suffered from certain internal racial tensions.
Yes, I mean, that was the problem that they foresaw.
Most likely.
Yes.
Place.
Yes,
trouble.
Yes. And of course, funnily enough, the New Hebrides had racial tension a few years back. It's now called Vanuatu, I think, or Vanuatu. And I think it was about 1979, 1980, there was a problem there.
Yes.
Then, and this again was caused by, I think, a sort of tribal tension between two ethnic groups.
Presumably you weren't doing this planning on your own. You were staff captain, presumably part of a team.
I mean, you're talking overall or for this particular trip?
I'm talking about overall.
Overall, I was part of a team. My boss was a DQMG, a major sapper. He was a gunner. So the first chap was a gunner. The second chap was a sapper. But I was very much. He tended to deal in the more strategic stuff, and I tended to deal with the day-to-day, everyday, you know, we got a problem, being rung up at night sometimes at home by the chap saying, "We got a problem, please, how do we sort it out?" That sort of thing. I tended to deal with the day-to-day stuff.
And would that be mainly in theatre rather than...
It was in theatre, yeah. And for example... I'm just trying to think of some of the other things that I got involved in. I mean, I was in the tiny little group of chaps who manned a special ops room up there, the Army Ops Room, which was only manned by Q Ops, G Ops, and GSD. And so we had a small little sort of gang of us who were there manning the Ops Room in Phoenix Park.
This is watchkeeping.
But it was only at night. I mean, during the day, it was manned by a permanent team of chaps who were in there, whose job it was to man it. But then at night, we went in there and used to sleep in there and be prepared to actually react to whatever the situation was that arose. And, for example, Hong Kong was a good example of how it all blew up and it had to be reinforced. And I happened to be on duty that day, so the battalion, it was actually 40 Commando, the CO and his ops officer and adjutant all trooped into my into the ops room and were given a briefing by me as to, you know, what was going to happen next.
And how did you arrange things like sea transport? Did you go through Navy or
we had a transport cell in the headquarters, a sea transport cell, which was manned by RCT transporters. So if we wanted merchant ships to take stuff, we'd go and say, hey, I need a ship to take this load to A, to place X, or is there a ship going? And I used to go to a meeting every month called the Monthly Shipping Conference, which was looking at the shipping in the theatre and what it was doing, which is when I heard the lovely story of the chap who, whose job it was to clear loads through the customs at Calcutta, whose normal routine was to buy a cheap pen and leave it behind by mistake as part of the sort of, you know, smoothing the process of getting it through customs in Calcutta. And on one occasion he forgot himself and took with him a beautiful silver parka that his wife had given for his birthday, and which he had no intention of handing over, and the customs clerk looked at it and said, my God, with a pen like that you could get a bill through Congress.
And did you, I mean, as part of, you say you were close to the joint theatre headquarters.
Yeah.
Were you liaising directly with them?
Yes, we were.
On a level?
Yes, we were, on a level business, because it was like a miniature MOD, if you like.
Yes.
In Phoenix Park was the joint theatre headquarters with the CNC and his staff, who were Army, Navy, Air Force. So that's like the central staff in the MOD. And then the Army Department, Navy Department and Air Force Department also had cells there, which dealt with them, and then were able to branch out to their own headquarters. Our own headquarters was at Tanglin, that was the main Army HQ, and then the Navy's headquarters was up in the dockyard, and the RAF headquarters was out at Changi. Yes. So that was like Mod Army, Mod Navy and Mod Air talking to the centre, and it was replicating what was in the Mod, actually. Mm-hmm. It had been set up by Mountbatten a few years before.
I think there was a standard pattern. I think they had the same thing in the Middle East.
Yes, they had the same pattern in the Middle East.
To introduce some uniformity.
That's
so
right.
No matter where you were, you knew what you were doing and how things should be done.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you get a chance to go out to Borneo to see what was going on?
Oh, yes, I had to go and do that. Mm. Yeah, definitely. Mm. Because, you know, I had to see what their problems were and what they needed.
What were their problems?
Well, their problems logistically were the huge distances over which they were supplying bases on the border. Mm. All by air. And it was three ways, either by helicopter or by small fixed-wing aeroplanes or airdrop from Beverly's. Mm. I mean, some of it went by river, but not much.
Mm. What was the best method? Was it helicopter?
So the best way by helicopter, because you can sort of take it straight to the point of delivery. Mm. the beavers, of course, used to land. Mm.
That involves having a strip.
That had a strip. Quite a lot of the bases had strips.
Mm. But a pad is easier to prepare.
Mm. And then if you were delivering a long distance, remember that the range of helicopters in those days was pretty small with any sort of load, and particularly as you were flying hot and high, which is what they didn't like, then you'd airdrop from a Beverly. Mm.
The airdrop was always a rather chance affair, isn't it?
Yes, and you tended to...
Lack of accuracy.
Well, it wasn't bad, I mean, because they were coming in quite low, and they'd have a... They were pretty good, actually. They dropped most of the loads in the right place. And usually, the sort of stuff they'd drop was the heavier stuff, like barbed wire and pickets gun ammunition, water ammunition, and stuff. But they actually got to the stage where they could drop eggs.
Mm. Are eggs less sensitive than mortar ammunition?
Yeah, well, they're more. But I mean, there was a way they could pack them, and they were all packed by specialist trained packers, and all thrown out the back, kicked out the back by the air dispatch boys. Mm. And it was quite a sight. I mean, I used to go on airdrops to see how it was going. Yeah. To watch this great sort of barn door swinging round and all this stuff hurtling out.
Presumably, you had to liaise with our Royal Air Force Transport Command for that.
Oh, yes. But that, again, was all done through the transport cell, you see. Yeah. It was a transport cell. So I didn't actually have to personally ring up the Air Force and say I'd like a Beverly tomorrow. And that was done through the transport cell.
You were doing
cell.
It indirectly through
yeah.
them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You mentioned Hong Kong blowing up. Did you have any forewarning of trouble in Hong Kong?
Not much. This was to do with what was it called? The Cultural Revolution.
Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution.
What was happening was they were threatening the border. I don't mean in a military way, but with lots of people sort of shouting and screaming and trying to get through the border post and stirring up trouble in Hong Kong with riots. Mm. And so Hong Kong had to be very quickly reinforced. Mm. And lots of supplies had to be sent up, stuff they didn't have, wire and pickets and sandbags and stuff like that.
Mm. How did you get the reinforcements to them? Were they flown?
They were flown. Mm.
From Singapore?
From Singapore. Mm. And in fact, on one occasion, they were taken on the occasion I briefed 40 Commander, they went up by LPH because they take the helicopters up and they were able to go up and get cracking straight away.
But that would take a while.
Yes, but it was deemed worthwhile. Mm. In order to get that you know, something like 16 helicopters up there.
Yes.
You know, the dead delay of whatever it was, 3 or 4 days.
How did you do your business normally? Did you do it by written paper or by telephone or by face-to-face meeting or by conference?
Most of the business was done face-to-face or over the telephone. Not much written stuff, because it wasn't fast enough, really. And it tended to be sort of, we want it now, or yesterday. Mm. So it was tended to be over the phone, or going to see people and saying, please make it so.
Mm. Were you working regular office hours?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And were you normally working on your own, or were you doing teamwork?
I was normally on my own, but working to a team plan, to the extent that the ops chaps would say, you know, hey, we want this, and this, and can you let us know by 10 o'clock whether it'll happen and how it'll happen? Then I'd go away and sort it out, and then come back and say, okay, you can have this, and this, but the other's going to take a bit longer, it's got to be flown out from UK or something.
What's it like living in
very pleasant.
Singapore?
Very pleasant. I mean, we had a nice house with a garden and two armours, a wash armour and a general armour, who did everything, housekeeping, cooking, looking after the children, the lot. And so, you know, you could go out in the evening without bothering about babysitters, you know, you could have a lovely time. Mm. And it was very so. There was a huge British, you know, team of people in Singapore, and one I belonged to a thing called the Tanglin Club, where we used to swim and have curry lunches. And my wife used to exercise polo ponies, so we belonged to the polo club. I didn't play polo, but it was a good place to drink and watch other people playing polo. Mm. We used to go out on Sundays and hire a boat and go and anchor it off Singapore and swim and picnic and things like that. So it was all great fun.
Mm. What was the political situation like in Singapore?
Very stable at the time. The sort of in what had happened just before we arrived, Singapore had broken away from Malaysia, and Lee Kuan Yew had the place completely sewn up, and there was no trouble at all. Mm. As far as I can remember, I didn't remember any sort of rioting or dissent or any problem whatsoever.
And what about the situation in Malaya? Was there any?
Malaya was okay. I mean, the campaign had been won 6 years before. Mm. There was no problems there. The only problem was in East Malaysia in Borneo.
You said that was beginning to.
That packed up.
run down while you were there.
Yes, it ended very suddenly. Actually, it didn't run down really. It ended about in the middle of 1966, I would say, after I'd been there about 6 months. And it really stopped because Sukarno, if you remember, was deposed, and they also had a huge internal problem, an uprising. And they decided that really, in going on with this confrontation thing, was a diversion which they couldn't afford. So they just packed it up and just stopped like that.
I think there are...